It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're talking about noodles and pasta and all their many varieties on this week's edition of Food Friday, and you could join in with your favorite noodle dishes. First, research has found that COVID-19 infection significantly increases the risk of developing diabetes. A study published in the medical journal Lancet last month found that the risk of getting type 2 diabetes increased 40% among those infected with COVID compared with those who didn't get COVID. COVID's also been shown to increase the risk of type 1 diabetes in those under age 18 compared to those who never got COVID. We're talking about this research finding the link between COVID infection and later diabetes diagnosis, especially type 2. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you've been through yourself? Did you or a loved one develop diabetes after a COVID infection? What questions do you have about the link between COVID and diabetes? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis is a professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. She's an expert in type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Dr. Davis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, Dr. Davis, I'd heard a lot about the risks of COVID for people who already had diabetes. That seems like it's been pretty clear for a while. This was news to me, though, that having been through COVID, you have an elevated risk of being diagnosed with diabetes. What do we know about that so far?
Right. Yeah. So you're right. There has been pretty clear evidence from the beginning of the pandemic that patients who have obesity or type 2 diabetes seem to be at increased risk for more severe outcomes related to COVID infection. And what has been emerging now over the last, several months as we compile all the information from the patients who've been infected with COVID over the last 2 years, honestly, there's some conflicting data. A vast majority of the studies do seem to support that there's an increased risk of patients developing diabetes after they've had a COVID infection. So we know that while they have their COVID infection and they're in the hospital, they definitely are at higher risk of having high blood sugars or diabetes. But these are even patients who are now recovered from COVID, more than a month, up to a year or so after their infection. And we're seeing increased rates of diabetes, new diabetes diagnosis during those time periods.
I know type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, we call it both diabetes. They're both kind of different in their causes, their outcomes. There's some overlapping treatment. Are we seeing elevated risks of both of these kinds of diabetes post-COVID?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So type 2 diabetes is the form of diabetes that we typically think of more in adults. It's associated with obesity and is the most common form of diabetes. And that's where most of the data comes from, is looking at patients who had newly diagnosed diabetes. Most of those were with type 2 diabetes. And, the reasoning behind why we're seeing this increased incidence with COVID infection, we really don't know that answer. There's a lot of theories. We know that the COVID virus itself can actually infect the cells within your body, the beta cells that make insulin. So it could be a direct damage to those insulin producing cells. We also know that with infection, there's increased amounts of these inflammatory signals and stress hormones that can worsen diabetes or lead to diabetes. But there's some other interesting, ideas too. One is that a lot of patients may not have had good access to medical care or not having frequent medical care. And then after their COVID infection, they come in for more medical care and may end up being diagnosed with diabetes that could have possibly even been there before their diagnosis. And this is an important point because we know that if you look across the board, about 20% of the people who have diabetes are actually undiagnosed. They don't even realize they have it. So possibly some of these signals we're seeing could actually just be from patients having more medical care and getting diagnosed. And then the last important point is that we know that COVID infection has hit certain populations harder than others, particularly in this country. And some of those populations do have higher risk factors for diabetes due to social determinants of health, things like lower socioeconomic status, less access to high quality food, less access to the ability to exercise. And so again, comparing apples to oranges, sometimes we might see an increased rate of diabetes in these patients that may be explained by something other than the infection. So it's complicated. And then briefly to touch on the type 1 diabetes story, type 1 diabetes is caused by autoimmune disease, and it happens usually in children or young adults. And in this case, we know that type 1 diabetes sometimes is triggered by a virus infection. And so there's a possible link there with the COVID virus and type 1 diabetes. But the data there is still emerging, whether there's truly an increased rate of type 1 or not in patients with COVID infection.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW's School of Medicine, looking at links between COVID-19 and different kinds of diabetes. As we're hearing, a lot of research going on, more still needed. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, what are you hoping to see? Do you think we should be monitoring people after COVID, watching closely for potential signs of diabetes?
Yeah, I think that certainly in, you know, the adult population, particularly those who already have risk factors for diabetes, I think absolutely after COVID infection, they should have a little closer monitoring and, you know, be screened for diabetes on a more regular basis. In kids, it's a little harder with the type 1 diabetes because, again, we aren't 100% clear on that connection, and we don't routinely screen children for type 1 diabetes either. But certainly if they had other risk factors, it would be important to follow up on that.
And flipping things back around, and the elevated risk for people, as you were saying earlier, who have type 2 diabetes, why did that make them more vulnerable to severe impacts of COVID?
Yeah, and that's a great question, too. I think, you know, those patients tend to have some other things going on at the same time. They often also have high blood pressure, are at higher risk for heart disease and stroke, are more susceptible just to having those very high blood glucose levels during their infection, which can make it harder to treat and manage the infectious process. So sort of a whole bunch of factors that play into that.
In general, for people who have been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, whether it's post-COVID or not, what are the main things they need to do when it comes to treatment and healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the number one thing is making sure that we have patients being screened for diabetes and being, you know, diagnosed as soon as possible. When they are diagnosed, you know, managing their diabetes usually involves a combination of things, but medications are often required. It's not necessarily something that you can manage with diet and exercise alone. In some patients with type 2 diabetes, they may even require insulin therapy. And so it's just important to follow up with your healthcare providers and find the right treatment for you. You know, importantly, we want patients to recognize that diabetes is a disease like everything else, and it needs medical treatment. We don't want patients to feel like that they're necessarily always to blame for their diabetes, and which there's a lot of stigma sometimes around that. So it's important to recognize, get good medical care, do your best on lifestyle changes, but, you know, focus on getting the treatment that you need.
Dr. Davis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. That's Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW's School of Medicine. She talked to us about COVID and its link with diabetes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In just a few minutes, we're going to turn to insulin and the cost of insulin, a bill in Congress aimed at reducing the cost. How big a deal is that for you and your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The U.S. House passed a bill last month that would cap the price of insulin at $35 a month. People with type 1 diabetes need insulin to survive. It can also help people with type 2 control blood sugar and avoid complications like kidney damage and nerve damage. Human Rights Watch earlier this month called unaffordable insulin in the U.S. a human rights abuse. Supporters of the bill say they want to make affordable insulin a reality for the nearly 2 million Americans with type 1 who need it to live. Others who benefit from the therapy would still need to pass in the U.S. Senate to take effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone in your family relies on insulin, can you talk about the cost? How affordable, how available is it for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic and editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He's the author of a research paper titled "The High Cost of Insulin in the United States: An Urgent Call to Action." Dr. Rajkumar, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, starting with this bill, it passed the House, still waiting for action in the Senate. How big a deal would it be for the cost of insulin?
Well, I think it's a small step forward, not a big move, because it covers one drug. It covers copay, which is important to patients, and it caps the copay at $35, as you said, but it doesn't cap the cost of insulin. So if the cost keeps going up and the copay is kept constant, then the premiums and taxes would go up on everyone else. And then finally, it doesn't cover the uninsured and the underinsured, who are the ones paying facing a lot of this burden. About 25% of the insured population will benefit because they are currently paying more than $35 or more for their insulin.
I talked to you about this when your paper that I referenced came out, Dr. Rajkumar. Can you compare and contrast the cost, the price of insulin in the United States with other comparable industrialized countries?
It's a huge difference, and that's what makes it such a big problem. It's the same insulin. It's the same insulin since, the late 90s and 2000s till now. And it costs at least 10 times more in the U.S. for all types of analog insulins than in any of the other developed countries. So the reports are like, you can compare to 30 different countries with benchmarked, and we would be insulin costs in the U.S. are 10 times or more higher.
What drives that?
Well, we have a number of issues here. There is no negotiation on the price of insulin, so it's whatever pharmaceutical companies set. There's a monopoly on the product itself, with very few companies controlling most of the market. And then there's a lot of people who benefit in the middle, from wholesalers to pharmacy benefit managers to others, who all benefit from a high price. So it's multiple factors, as I outline in the paper, and it's not an easy solution.
What kind of solutions do you point to try to bring those numbers down?
I think negotiating for the price of insulin and capping the actual list price and lowering the list price would be the main thing, since Medicare Part D covers insulin, and allowing more biosimilars to enter the market so that there's competition would be another second step. Having some transparency in the arrangements between pharmaceutical companies and pharmacy benefit managers in terms of what is causing the difference between the list price and what insurance companies are paying for the product.
You mentioned all those other countries where insulin is way cheaper. Are those factors present there, or is it just a completely different system and it's kind of hard to compare the U.S. with what they're doing?
It's completely different system, because in almost all the developed countries, the government is paying for the cost of these drugs. And so they negotiate not just for insulin. And that's why a solution just for insulin is not enough, because we have the same problem in cancer drugs. We have the same problem in high, any novel treatments that we bring about, that if we don't negotiate and there is a monopoly, then prices will be very, very high. And they are always higher in the U.S. than in other countries.
Talking to Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, professor at the Mayo Clinic, looking at the price of insulin, a bill in the House aiming to cap the cost to consumers for their monthly insulin supply. But as Dr. Rajkumar says, that means that the cost will go somewhere else. He's looking for more fundamental solutions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you want to see happen to bring down the cost of insulin or other expensive prescription medications? Do you rely on insulin or one of those other very expensive medications? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Rajkumar, I referenced earlier, a lot of people rely on insulin literally to live. Can you talk about what insulin means for people with type 1 diabetes and then type 2 diabetes?
Sure. You know, insulin is critical for our survival. Type 1 diabetics, and I think there's more than a million type 1 diabetics, 1 to 2 million type 1 diabetics in the U.S., they did nothing wrong. They just developed this autoimmune type disorder, and the cells that make insulin in the pancreas don't exist. So they need insulin for survival, and without insulin, they will die. And so it's for nothing that they did wrong. Now, for their whole lives, they have to rely on insulin. And it's really important that we don't penalize them for a disease that they you know, didn't have any control over. So for them, it's life or death. And so they will buy it no matter how expensive it is. And that's something that we have to keep in mind, that there is a product which is so important for survival that if you have a monopoly over that, then it does cause a problem. For millions of other Americans who have type 2 diabetes, insulin is still very important. And some people point out, oh, there's obesity or there's other things that you can control. Yes, but there are many, many people who need insulin to live a long life. If you don't treat the diabetes now, then we will pay extra to take care of the heart disease or any other problems that follow downstream. So insulin means a lot. It's a hormone we all need for survival. And we should try to make it affordable, just like it is in all other developed countries.
Now, given that this is a market, Dr. Rajkumar, I would imagine if it's a case where only a few companies are selling insulin at a high cost, another company, if I were another pharmaceutical company, I'd want to get in on it, undercut them a little bit, take some of this high demand market from them. Why doesn't it play out that way?
So some factors. One is that companies which own these analog insulins, like Sanofi, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, they keep filing newer and newer patents on the same insulin, which trying to prolong the patent life and preventing competition from entering. Secondly, insulin is a hormone, so you cannot just make a generic. The analog insulin companies would have, who want to enter the market, would have to convince the FDA that they have a biosimilar that is exactly similar in bio, you know, in how it works to the parent compound. And that is a more difficult process than getting a generic drug approved, which is just a chemical, and you can show that it's the identical chemical. So it's a harder process. So biosimilars have been late to come in. And naturally, because it's a biosimilar, only big pharma is making it. So some of the biosimilars we have on the market are also made by big pharma, and they also want to make money.
You've used the phrase analog insulin. What, and I've heard that elsewhere. What does that mean?
So the normal human insulin that we make in the pancreas is extremely good. But one of the best things that happened in the late 90s, 2000s was the analog insulin, which actually worked even better than human insulin, which when given externally to diabetics. Analog insulins have a more predictable time of action, a more predictable duration of action. And so most of the modern insulins that people use now are analog insulins. They're not exactly identical to the human insulin that we make in the pancreas.
How long have we had insulin as a medication?
Insulin's been around since 1921, but we have always made modifications to insulin. So it was the first, the beef insulin, then the porcine insulin, then the human insulin, and then the analog insulin. So every few decades, there's been a modification, and every modification meant new patents, and slowly that translated into higher cost.
Could somebody patent, I don't know, like, or produce an old school insulin, the stuff we were using 20, 30 years ago, and maybe it's not quite as good as this analog insulin, but it's still maybe life-saving?
It's still available. You know, the so-called Walmart insulin is Humulin. It's the human insulin. It's not analog insulin. It has some disadvantages. So for an insulin-dependent diabetic, it would change their lifestyle. You know, they would have to be monitored multiple times a day. They could get high and low blood sugars much more frequently. And so it's not fair to patients when we have products on the market for 22 years and 25 years that we tell them use the products that were around 40 years ago.
Do you have hopes that companies are going to get some of these different analog insulins on the market anytime soon that will help bring the price down?
Yeah, there are a couple of biosimilars already on the market. Now, the madness is there is that, you know, even say Eli Lilly is making what is called an authorized generic, which is taking their same insulin, putting a different label on it and selling it at a half price. You may ask then, why would somebody buy the full price version? People do buy it because, like I said, there's a lot of people who profit in the middle from a higher cost product. So, the existence of an authorized generic made by the same company that's making the parent compound and selling that at half price tells you what's wrong with our system.
Briefly, Dr. Rajkumar, what is your best hope for something that's going to happen in the next maybe few years to bring down the price of insulin for those who depend on it, just in our last minute or so?
I think insulin is the Achilles heel of the pharmaceutical industry because it's been around for 20 years and there's no, you know, it's a novel drug, therefore it's expensive argument. If we can solve, but we should use insulin as the face of the problem and then enact a change in that would affect all prescription drugs. Not to take away profits from any company, not to take away innovation. I work with pharmaceutical companies closely. I work on new drugs. I understand their importance, but it has to be fair. Medicare should be able to negotiate for the price of the drug based on the value it provides, just like other countries do.
Dr. Rajkumar, thanks again for joining us today. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic, editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He talked to us about the cost of insulin in the United States as Congress works on a bill to at least lower what insured consumers pay. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We're talking about all things noodle with the authors of the new cookbook, That Noodle Life. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wausau's mayor tells us about the city's latest efforts to deal with toxic so-called forever chemicals in drinking water. And we check out a recent court ruling that could limit the state DNR's ability to act on those chemicals under Wisconsin's spills law. Now, spaghetti, vermicelli, bucatini, lo mein, there's a wide, wide world of noodles out there. Our guests today are two card-carrying members of the Noodle Fan Club, and they say whether you want an elaborate, tasty dish to share or just a quick and yummy dinner, noodles are there for you. It's Food Friday, and we're talking about noodles and pasta, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of noodle to cook with or eat? Your favorite recipe? Do you like them in soup, with a sauce, straight up with butter? Have you ever made your own noodles, your own pasta? How'd it go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike and Stephanie Lee are the creators of the I Am a Food blog. Their new cookbook is That Noodle Life, soulful, savory, spicy, slurpy. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how's it going, Rob?
Good. And Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Stephanie, can you start out by telling us just about your love for noodles?
I love noodles. I think I've always loved noodles. They've been one of my favorite foods ever since I was a little kid. And it was just such an amazing experience to be able to write a book about, you know, a food that most of the world has eaten before.
And Mike, there are so many cultures that eat noodles and so many kinds of noodles within each of those food traditions. How did you try to narrow it down and fit what you could into just one book?
Well, we couldn't actually. We had twice, or I think maybe even three times as many recipes, and our editor was just after us. He's like, the book is too long, guys. You can't have this. And over time, you know, we whittled it down, but this is definitely not all we wanted to put in.
Now, Stephanie, I've never made my own noodles, you know, and I'm okay with that, but I always get the sense like, oh, I'm really missing out. It'd be way better if I made my own noodles. You write in the book, not necessarily. We can do pretty well with store-bought stuff.
That's absolutely true. Like, it's super fun to make your own pasta, but like, let's face it, it's really easy to go out and buy high quality bronze extruded pasta. So when you get like dried pasta from the store, like those people that are making it are obviously like experts. So, you know, they know what they're doing. And also when you cook dried pasta, it absorbs the sauce more. So you actually get more flavor in the noodles. Whereas when you're cooking fresh noodles, sometimes, you know, if you're not really experienced, they can fall apart in the sauce. So, you know, store-bought's great too.
And Mike, one tip, and I've heard this from a past Food Friday guest, Lydia Bastianich, if you're buying dry stuff, it should be rough, not smooth. Why is that?
The rough edges and the rough surfaces pick up the sauce better, whereas, you know, with the smooth pastas, that's actually the cheaper kind of pastas because the tooling is cheaper to make. The sauce slides right off of it and you're not really getting anything there. You know, it's just basically eating plain wheat and then you're eating sauce afterwards.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about noodles with Stephanie Lee and Mike Lee. They have a new cookbook out. It's called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of noodles? What kind? How do you like to eat them? What kind of restaurants do you like to go to for noodle dishes? Do you have questions about cooking them right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephanie, I thought this was interesting, especially with those dry store-bought noodles, saucing the noodles. Can you talk about, you know, the cooking time on that dry pasta if we're going to be cooking it in then with the sauce?
Yeah, so we recommend that you cook it a little bit shy of what they suggest on the package so that you can finish your noodles in the sauce so that when you're cooking it at the end, the sauce is really soaking into the pasta. So you get like a complete bite of sauce. So you get a complete bite of pasta infused sauce. Oh, no, wait, sauce infused pasta.
Either way works for me. I'm good with both.
That's right.
And Mike, using some of our pasta water in the final sauce, what does that do for us?
It emulsifies the sauce. Basically, the starch in the pasta goes into the water. And then when you put that water back into the sauce, it makes the sauce thicker and glossier.
Now, you've shared a few recipes with us. We've got them up online at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you've got some, you know, serious project type recipes. And you've got a whole chapter on kind of quick and easy recipes. Let's start with one of those, Stephanie. This one sounds great. Spicy sesame chili oil noodles. Can you tell us a little bit about this recipe?
It's kind of like a take on sesame noodles that you get from takeout, yeah. But instead, mostly those are made with like peanut butter. So this is a bit more traditional, made with Chinese sesame paste. And then we have like some chili oil and there's some Chinese black vinegar, which these are ingredients that like are easily found online. But we also included some substitutions if you need them. So you can use stuff like tahini or just regular balsamic vinegar, and it's just a spicy, nutty, savory, tangy, like really savory noodle dish that you'll want to eat more and more of.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hi. I just thought I'd comment on my favorite noodles are those made by Hua Ki in Madison, a wonderful northern Chinese noodles made from wheat. And they're made in his business. Very good. Another thing, a comment, I wonder if you people on our show here have ever made your noodles by hand, like the Uyghurs do when they stretch it from their two hands repeatedly over and over and over until they finally get some, you know, noodles rather than a big mass of dough.
John, thanks for the call. Before I let you go, I think I got some bad news for you, pal. Waukee closed a while back. They have really good, noodles though. I'm right there with you, John. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry to break the tidings to you. Yeah. But John, thank you for calling in. That hand stretched noodles, Mike, is that something, I feel like I've seen video of that. Is that something you've worked on or seen in action?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to do it, right? Like, there's hand-pulled noodles, which we actually have in a book, right, where you're just kind of slapping them against the table and they get longer and longer and longer. And then there's also hand, I think Stephanie can fill me in here better, but basically, like, you know, handmade noodles where, like, as you pull them, they turn into noodles. And, like, you know, first you get two and then you get four and then eventually you get, like, 100,000 noodles. Is that what you're thinking of?
That's right. Yeah. There are two kinds of Chinese noodles like that. Like, yeah, they're both made with wheat, like the caller said. And like one, you can, we have one recipe in the book where you can just pull them and they're really easy to make because you're just making one giant noodle. And there's another one where it's a bit more complicated where you kind of make ropes upon ropes of noodles and then you keep pulling them. But either way, hand-pulled Chinese noodles are definitely really, really delicious. And we do have a recipe for that in the book.
Now, if I wanted to make a Chinese noodle dish at home, the pasta I know comes in different sort of forms and formats than maybe that bag, of, that box of spaghetti or whatever. What should we look for, Stephanie, in the stores as we're buying noodles for our sesame noodles or other Asian-style dishes? And I know, again, there's a lot of variety there.
Yeah. Well, for the sesame noodles, you can actually just use any noodle you like. Like, we have definitely eaten that sauce with spaghetti before. But if you're looking for, like, a Chinese noodle, you can just go for a straight-up wheat noodle, and they just call them wheat noodles. Or if you go to the refrigerator section, they have these noodles called lo mein noodles, and those are already cooked. And, yeah, or you can even use instant noodle packets and just take the sauce packet out and just use the instant noodles, too. That works great.
Now, moving back to Italy, Mike, I understand you're a big fan of lasagna. Can you tell us what grabs you about this? Is the big baked pasta dish there?
It is. And, you know, like, there's, I mean, everyone loves lasagna, so it's not
to go wrong.
To explain,
yeah.
The... Yeah, exactly. We love it, though, because, you know, like, when we were writing the noodle book, we're like, what is a noodle? And we were discussing the pros and cons of all the different kinds of noodles and filled noodles and things like that. And we realized, you know, lasagna is like just the world's largest noodle that literally anyone eats. So big that it fills a pan. And, you know, that's just something that we just really love to celebrate.
We're talking to Mike and Stephanie Lee about their new cookbook. It's called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpee. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the best noodle dish you've ever had anywhere? Homemade, restaurant made, traveling, or whatever? Do you have a favorite noodle-related comfort food dish that you go back to again and again? Or do you have questions for our guest about anything noodle cooking related? They probably have an answer for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check out WPR.org/Food Friday for a few recipes from Stephanie and Mike. We've talked about one of them. We'll get into one or two more as we go on. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about noodles, pasta, and the new cookbook, That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpee. Authors Mike and Stephanie Lee stay with us, and you can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your noodle favorites, your noodle questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go back to your calls now. Bruce is with us in Madison. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I have a question on taste. I've had, just like many people, different brands of pasta, and have looked at the ingredients on the boxes, and they look identical, but yet the different brands of pasta taste different. Some taste a lot worse than others. Some taste a lot better. I read that it might be because some manufacturers rush the drying time. I had a question on why is that?
That's a noodle mystery, Bruce. Thanks. Stephanie, do you have a thought about that?
Even though the ingredients might be the same, the ratios or the proportions that the makers are making it with are probably different. So, you know, it's a question that, like, pasta's made, well, it can be made with just water and wheat, but it can also be made with eggs, but then you get all different kinds of ratios within that. And also it does have to do with the drying time as well. And also the machinery that they use to extrude it. So yeah, that's why they all taste different. And also the salt content too.
Thanks a lot for that call.
And I just want to jump in there. Oh, I just wanted to say the reason that the manufacturers rush the drying time is because of real estate. And so the longer the drying time, the more room they need at the factory. Oh. That's why the slow dried pastas tend to cost a lot more money.
Interesting. Okay, thanks a lot for that call. I want to check out another recipe you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Bun Bo Wei. You say it's kind of like a Vietnamese pho soup, but even more fun in some ways. Mike, do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, it's a lot more fun because, you know, pho is kind of like a universally loved because it's not that neutral. It's a very neutral tasting soup, whereas BBH is what we call it because it's easier to say. It's spicy and it's flavorful. It explodes in your mouth, and it's just like a lot of fun to eat. And like there's a lot of meats that you can eat it with, and there's a, you know, it's a thick, chewy noodle, not like quite as tender as pho, and it's just like by far the better version. You know, like if you ever had like a really good pasta and then you go back to like marinara, that's kind of like how it feels.
That is at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Hayward. Rick, hi.
Good afternoon. So I want to talk about the power of the noodle. I've been aggressively trying to get hired at a high-volume Italian restaurant with no success. I called them a number of times. I just couldn't get it done. So I made a pan of stuffed rigatoni with homemade tomato sauce and Italian sausage, and the owner called me today, and I start next week.
Awesome, so Rick.
Amazing.
Buying them lunch. Yeah, they don't need my resume. They just needed my stuffed rigatoni.
You could drop the name, Rick. Where are you working?
It's called Marie's Hideaway in Stone Lake, Wisconsin. It's a nice Italian restaurant. They do a lot of business in summer.
Rick, thanks so much. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
And, you can drop by down here at the rigatoni sometime, too. I'd appreciate that, Rick. You know, Steph, I mean, we haven't talked much, just the cultural power of the noodles. There's something comforting that I think is a great way to entertain people and win people over, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I think, like, when you invite someone into your home and you serve them noodles, it's kind of like saying, like, hey, like, you're like, a really good friend. You're, like, my family, because, like, noodles, like, kind of have that kind of casual vibe. So I think it just says to someone, like, let's relax and eat noodles together.
And Mike, that was a stuffed pasta. Now, you talk about the definition of noodles in the book. Is stuffed pasta still a noodle? Is a dumpling still a noodle? Where do we draw those lines?
Well, that is actually about the line that we kind of came up with. Like, we're like, yes, it's, you know, stuffed pasta is a noodle because pasta is a noodle. And, you know, what's ravioli or even rigatoni, right, if it's not a noodle? And then we got into, like, dumplings like gyoza and, like, you know, like Chinese pot stickers. And we're like, yeah, it's still a noodle. And, you know, at the end of the day, we didn't really know what to say except that you know a noodle when you see it.
Thanks again for that call, Rick, and congratulations. We'll go to Wyatt now in Whitewater. Wyatt, hello.
Hi. I was just, so some of my favorite meals, like comfort meals, have always been like linguine aglio olio and spaghetti cacio e pepe. And I was wondering if you had any other ideas for these meals that are really simple as far as the ingredients go, but kind of elevate all of the, like, few ingredients that they use.
And Wyatt, my Italian isn't so hot. Is aglio olio, that means with garlic? Do I have that right?
Yeah, sorry, that's garlic and oil.
Nailed it. Ha! Wyatt, thank you so much for sharing that. So yeah, great, let's throw that one at Stephanie. Great kind of simple recipes like that that really bring out the flavor.
Well, you can always riff on those ones. Like aglio olio, if you add like a little bit of miso paste, it'll give you some extra umami. Or if you add some more aromatics that you don't normally add, like instead of garlic, you can go with, I don't know, shallots or something like that. And like, you know, it's basically the same kind of comfort food, but elevating it even more. Or like when you even have like butter pasta, if you take the time to brown the butter, then you get like a nice nutty flavor, and brown butter pasta is actually really good. You should try it.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Stephanie Lee and Mike Lee. Their new cookbook is called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpee. Still time for you to join this Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234 with your noodle questions or your favorites. 800-642-1234 is the number. Mike, here's one of my noodle pratfalls. When I've cooked with rice noodles, I get the timing wrong. I end up with sort of hot, watery rice mush. How do I not do that?
Well, we always say that, especially with dried pasta and dried noodles, you should trust the timing on the package. That said, we also are guilty of just, you know, pulling one out and tasting it and just trying it that way. With rice noodles, actually, I found that when it comes to getting mushy noodles, sometimes one of the secrets for us is using really rolling, like not quite as hot water as like a rolling boil. And often you get a better result that way.
All right, let's hit some of the basics here. Stephanie, rinse or not rinse when it's done cooking?
Ooh, if you're talking about rice noodles, then you probably do want to rinse them. But if we're talking about pasta, never, ever, unless you're making like a pasta salad or something. But the pasta water helps like the sauce cling to the pasta, ironically. So you never really want to rinse it, because when you're rinsing it, then you're washing all the starch off, and then the sauce just kind of slides off if you use rinsed pasta. So we're not going to rinse pasta.
Okay, but a particular wife of mine says, you got to rinse it or it's going to keep cooking and it's going to get too overcooked. What about that?
Ooh, no, 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 no. Well, first off, like we suggested earlier, you got to pull the pasta a couple minutes earlier than the cook time and then finish it in the sauce. So then you won't have that problem of it overcooking, because you're pulling it from the boiling water a little bit early.
All right, Mike. And then cooking the pasta, salt, lots of salt, no salt. What's the rule there?
Well, you know, everyone's heard about the salt to like the Mediterranean, but we actually say, you know, a little bit of salt, because you're going to want to use that pasta water to loosen up your sauce later. So you don't want to over season.
All right. Now I got another recipe from you actually at WPR.org/Food Friday Bolognese. See, there's my bad Italian. Bolognese with pappardelle. You could correct me on that. Stephanie, it sounds really good. I looked over the recipe. Can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, well, I really love bolognese sauce, and we actually went to Bologna so that I could taste some authentic bolognese sauce. And this recipe is actually a little bit of a riff, because technically they use ground meats, but we went with whole cuts here so that they're like braised and really, really tender. And then the secret is actually chicken livers, which many people don't know, but it adds like an extra richness, and it's just like a hint in the background, and you can't even really taste it, but it adds an earthiness to it, and it just makes you want to eat more and more and more.
And Mike, Stephanie reminded me, a lot of this book, you've literally traveled the world seeking out great pasta. Can you talk a little bit about your journeys in search of the best noodles?
Yeah, you know, we've been lucky enough in our lives to be able to work from anywhere. So we took that opportunity to just travel, you know, wherever our heart fancies. And that tends to be just pretty much anywhere that there's been good noodles. So, you know, Japan and like anywhere in Europe that serves any kind of pasta that, you know, like is famous. So Bologna, a little bit of France, Spain, that kind of thing.
And Stephanie, if someone's thinking, yeah, I'd like to plan some noodle related travel, what would be your number one destination for them to hit?
Ooh, I would have to say my favorite noodle to travel for is udon, and you have to go to Japan for udon. And I don't know if most people like really love udon the way I do, but it's really, really delicious when you have it like handmade in Japan.
Mike, if I said to you, all right, you've got one comfort noodle dish that you could, you know, have when you need it quick, what is your go-to?
Mine's got to be just a really nice, simple sugo with like, if you know, what's your definition of comfort? Because mine is going to be handmade noodles, right? So it's handmade spaghetti a la chitara and sugo.
And how about you, Stephanie?
Ooh, I don't know. I love all noodles, so that's really, really hard. But I mean, right now in this moment, I think what would hit the spot is mac and cheese.
Yeah, you've got a pretty cool, like a, what was it? I read on the book, a Gruyere. It's like a French onion soup, but it's mac and cheese. Mm, tell us about that one. That sounded cool.
Yeah, it's basically like a French onion soup. So you have like slow cooked onions that are caramelized, so they taste like sweet, but with a lot of like depth of flavor. And then you have Gruyere cheese, and it's just melty and creamy, and like the noodles are tender, and it's I don't know, it's just so good.
That sounds fantastic. Mike, leave us with some noodle inspiration, please. What's a less well-known noodle dish you'd recommend we try to cook?
Ooh, putting me on the spot there. Yeah. I want to give this one over to Stephanie.
a less known noodle dish. I don't know. No. In Spain, they have paella made with noodles.
Ooh, that sounds pretty good. Yeah, all right.
Well, like that gives us
a lot to think about. Mike and Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Appreciate you having us, yeah.
That's Mike and Stephanie Lee. They are the creators of the I Am a Food blog, and we talked to them about their new cookbook. It's called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. We have some recipes and a link to the cookbook all at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can still share your favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Join lively conversations with information that affects your life each weekday on The Morning Show. Monday at 8, it's spring. Yay, it's allergy season. Boo. Find out how allergy season works and get some options for relief. That's Monday morning on the Ideas Network. I had a good Wisconsin moment yesterday. I was at a store that specializes in beverages, a beverage store, and the customer in front of me asked the cashier if they have a time machine in the store. The cashier says no, thinks for a moment, and says, but they have one at the grocery store down the street. And this is a little thing I love about Wisconsin. Now, if you haven't been in the state for too long, a time machine was a brand of ATM, a money machine. It was spelled T-Y-M-E, stood for Take Your Money Everywhere. They had that brand just here in Wisconsin, a couple few other places around the country. And I just like imagining if somebody had been there who didn't know all that and just heard some dudes talking about the nearest time machine without batting an eye, like, did they just wander into some weird science fiction world? Nope. It's just Wisconsin. We're your central time machine. This is the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.